Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting across from Fiona McIntosh. Welcome.
Lovely to be here again. Thanks.
And you're here to talk about Tea Gardens, your new novel.
I am.
So I love the fact that every time that you give yourself a new task, a new novel, that you set yourself a wonderful period of research, travelling the world and going to glorious places. Where have you gone to for this book?
For this book, we began in London, and then down to the south coast, Brighton Beach. And then, with no time to draw a breath, I whisk the readers off to the slums of Calcutta. So there's a real diversity. And then the story really kicks again when we head up into the Himalayas and the foothills just below Darjeeling town, where the glorious tea gardens of Breckenridge.
So your tax returns is filled with a folder called research, travel and dining. And
absolute legitimate research and dining. And
yes, so do you spend that much time away from Australia researching this book?
I do. I probably... all up, the actual physical research, where its location is, probably about 3 to 4 weeks for a book. Sometimes I might have to go back again, and I know people say, oh yeah, that's a really good... But honestly, I call this due diligence, and I have a creed that I will never write about a place unless I've been there.
So no Mars books for you?
No, definitely not. No Google Earth for me either. Yeah. I work... only with what I've seen and experienced. The serious side of this is I've got to create a world for the reader to topple into. I'm trying to create a different era. So in the tea gardens, it's 1933 Calcutta and Darjeeling. So in order to do that, you need to put your feet down in those places and then scratch the surface and try and go back through the decades and understand what would the atmosphere have been like. And you know, I hope that what any reader gets out of the book is that it feels authentic when they enter the pages and that they sort of topple helplessly into the era.
That's something that people, readers of your books are drawn to, and I think that's one of the reasons why you keep being a bestseller every year, which is extraordinary.
Thank you.
Is that you get the pull of the story, but you the research and the detail don't bog you down. Like you have a really wonderful balance between those two things, which I, having written myself, I find it very difficult to get that balance right, because you get so interested in the research.
No, that's so true. It's very easy, because I start the research 18 months out, so I start reading up about everything that I think might be useful for the book. So I don't have a plan for the book, but I knew it was going to be set in India, so I needed to read about Calcutta in the 1930s. And then I knew, okay, there are tea plantations, and that's going to be my motive for the story. So I needed to understand everything I could about the history of tea and how come it's in India. You know, how did it get out of China and end up in India as, you know, the main place that we derive our tea from? And then I needed to read.
So
I realized
that's a separate podcast. We can have a podcast just about tea.
Yes,
with your
we
experience.
Could. Yeah. I could tell you so many marvelous things about tea, and then about tropical medicine, because my main character, I decided, would be a doctor, which is not rare, but it wasn't usual in 1933 to have a female doctor. But there were plenty coming online, so to speak. So I needed to understand tropical medicine at the coalface in the slums of Calcutta. So there was, you know, a year's worth of reading there, and then the physical stuff of actually, let's go and find these destinations. How did she get to India? You know, which platform of which station does she arrive into? I know it sounds glamorous, but it's actually...
But do you go into that detail?
I do. I really do. And I went into every hotel that she could, and I walked down corridors, and I broke into bedrooms that I shouldn't be in, and I paced them out so I knew how many steps. I mean, I know this sounds very detailed, and I may not put all that detail in, but I need to understand it. And that's where that credibility comes when you read the story.
I think I've said this before. I think you're like the Marlon Brando or the Dustin Hoffman of writing.
The method.
Because it's definitely worth, I mean, your readers will tell you, it's definitely worth the effort.
Yes.
Because no one likes the not being able to see or smell it. Or
taste
it. Yeah,
all those things. When I'm talking about the Plymouth gin and the pink gins that they're drinking, I want the reader to feel, I think I can almost taste that.
Now, how many gins did you have to drink before you could do that one?
Yes, indeed. I certainly had to sip a few and understand how to make one. But, you know, just understanding how they taste tea, you know, and the process through tea. I begin to understand, having done this research, why the really high-quality teas of Darjeeling now fetch a price higher than gold. I understand it. When I'm buying it, before I'd done the research, how do they get away charging this kind of money? But it's very hand-intensive.
I don't want to put more work on you, but if anyone from Penguin is listening, they might want to put out a little companion non-fiction book with each. She's already done the research.
Yes, the book behind the book. Behind the book. We did that with The Perfumer's Secret, of course, because there was just so much to learn about it. That we did a companion book, but I think the tea definitely lends itself.
This kind of, but we've got to get to the story because I get myself caught up with how you do it. Tell us a little about the story.
So it is this woman who is pushing. I play with this theme a lot of women pushing back against society. They've just got the vote. It's the 1930s. Women are beginning to assert themselves in all sorts of facets of careers and industry. But there is still that expectation of making a good marriage and settling down and having children and all of that. And my character in this story is unlike most of them that I write about. She's very accepting of the fact that she will have to make a good marriage. But first, she's going to keep a promise to go and work at the Coalface of Medicine, which is in the slums of Calcutta. And so we join this woman as she sort of heads off on this grand adventure, ill-prepared for how, I guess, India's going to change her. Mm. It's going to challenge everything she thinks she knows about herself, and even down to her loyalties. It will make her reassess herself. And so it's got a scene in it that's going to be hard for some people to read through. I know my editor found it a challenge, and she even questioned, should this be in your story? And I said, absolutely, because I'm not a romance writer and I want people to start not seeing me as that. Yeah. I write adventuresome stories that have a lot more than the, obviously, there's always a romantic setting and then there will be a love story, of course there is, but there's a big story that bubbles around it with a lot of, I hope, enrichment for the reader as well.
Well, the thing which stands out for booksellers is you're not read just by women, you're read by men and women.
I am. A lot of mail from men about the stories, and they particularly enjoy the research behind each story. And I had to ride so many trains. I had to talk to so many little train buffs, weird little train buffs, about these magnificent Victorian railways in India. Mm. Now, I could only touch on that in the story without... This is the balance that you're talking about. But the research was amazing, to ride on these trains and learn about them, the feat of engineering... Up in the Himalayas, a train. You know, it's extraordinary. But you must never lose sight of the fact that somebody is paying money to be entertained. And so that's my job, is to make sure they can escape.
You can't just call them about trains in the Himalayas.
Or tea.
Yeah. And so in the 30s in India was a changing... It was the sort of the rise of Gandhi.
Rise of Gandhi. Yeah. And very much the dying days of the Raj. And this is an era that fascinates most readers. You know, even television serial producers love the dying days of the Raj. It was the Brits clinging on to that imperial attitude and way of life and living a very good life out in the colonies with lots of servants and small-time civil servants living the life of the, you know, emperors, so to speak. So it's a fabulous playground to move into to actually write a story. There's a lot of culture clash going on. There's a lot of pushback from the Indians wanting their independence and this Gandhi coming through. And I do mention him just on the sort of fringe of the story.
I love it when a story sort of just glances at history, just glances by.
Just brings it, you know, people will recognise it straight away. And then, you know, making that all come together, sewing it together into... a sort of an addictive read is the real trick, of course.
Yeah, well, that is the trick. And I remember our conversation last time where I think I may have got a little bit of the nitty gritty of your writing life, but I just found it so fascinating. You've written a book about how to write a bestseller, so you know, you're the person to talk to. you've got the credentials. You are a bestseller. You continually sell it. Every time you come out with a book, there's another bestseller. Like it's
Thank you.
Is Does that pressure mount, or do you get more comfortable as you do this? Are you getting...
Oh, that's a very good question. I'm highly aware that each book has to outsell the last one. I mean, that's the aim. Mm. You want your graph, your sales graph, always heading north, because then you've got a happy publisher and you've got happy booksellers. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's about the audience. Are they enjoying the book? So I don't let that impinge on story. For mm-hmm. me, story is king. I don't worry about it. So I don't even worry about what am I going to write next. Mm. I just think, put myself in the way of stories and the stories will tap me on the shoulder. So, you know I'm going to write a story set in Asia. I know I'm going to write a story set in Africa. And I'm not worrying about them. I just know I'll turn up,
mm-hmm.
I'll walk around, and a story will come and find me and say, this is the one.
Does that come with confidence? Has that been there from the beginning? Is that something that you get?
Done that from the beginning. Right. But I think, I suppose because I came to writing quite late, I was 40 before I even attempted to write a novel. And I think by the time you're 40, you've come into your own sense of self and power and who you are and what you want to do. So, and I'd been successful in business, so there is a certain amount of confidence that was coming behind that.
Well, a lot of people were actually happy to hear that you started at 40, because the people who go, it's too late.
I can't
follow my dreams. I can't write.
My masterclass is full of 50 plus.
Yeah.
You know, people thinking, no, if I don't do this now, I'm... And there are even older people. So, no, it's never too late to start telling a story. It never is. And in fact, I'd urge everyone who's thinking about it, you know, do it. Yeah. Do it. You just don't know.
Yeah.
I think I do gain more confidence. But what I try and do is I hope that my writing improves. And so I deliberately read people like Ian McEwan to make myself feel inadequate so that I never get so... caught up in that, you know, okay, you're a bestseller, that you think, okay, so I know the next one will be.
So what do you do? If you've done a draft, you're going back, you're looking at it. Are you being really critical about the structure of the sentence, structure of the paragraph, whether it actually evokes it, or whether you can use a more beautiful?
I'm actually ruthless, and I'm getting rid of any words that don't need to be there for a start. I mean, that's one of the most important parts of, you know, reworking your draft, is to cull the words, kill the darlings, as they say. You've got to. And any time that you think something is absolutely beautiful, you're usually wrong, and it's better to get rid of it. You need nice, sparse language. I'm not a literary fiction writer. I don't need to be poetic. I need to appeal to the widest possible market that can read me. So nice, simple language, pages that turn themselves. So it's about story and character. People rarely remember the beautiful writing. They often, commercial fiction, they remember the characters.
So it's a matter of I've written three paragraphs saying this one bit about this character. I need to get it right down so it just nails it in a few sentences. Yeah. That kind of.
And if you read someone like Ian McEwan, he can summarize a character in, you know, in a paragraph, and you think, good grief, I know everything I need to know about this fellow or this girl. It's such clever, brilliant storytelling, and I'm nowhere near that. So I force myself, it's like punishment, to read his work or other great writers, to say, all right, you've got a long way to go, you know. But repetitiveness and all that tends to creep in, so you have to get rid of all of that. So the read through is about being ruthless, and that's why I deliberately, as soon as I finish a book, I start writing another one. Deliberately, because what it does is it flings me in with a new cast of characters, and you lose that that sort of almost baby-like commitment to that first story.
Mm-hmm.
You can let go, and then when you go back, you've got really fresh, objective perspective on that book, and you're already in love with this lot anyway. So I've nearly finished the next book.
Right, so you're quite, like, you may not have completely finished one, and you've just rolled on and started the next.
No,
one.
I would have finished. I would have finished the first draft, but I would start writing a new one just to divorce myself.
And how long do you give? Because we were talking to Michelle de Kretzer, and she said she gave it 6 weeks. I was going, 6 weeks? That's a long time to leave a...
Oh, no, that's really good to do that. But what I do is, and I don't want any writers out there, to aspiring writers, to do this, I send usually my first draft off to my editor because she loves seeing it in the raw.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time she comes back to me, it would have been maybe 4 weeks.
Right.
And so I've got distance. I've already started a new story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not offended by any suggestions because I'm keen to get that one done and dusted so that I can...
That's a very good technique, actually.
Yeah.
Because it does give you that that perspective, which is not so wrapped up. You know, you've
definitely
moved on to new
definitely
new loves
you
and
have
new
to
interests.
Let go. You have to let go. Because otherwise there's a danger that you're still so deeply entrenched in the story. You know, I don't like talking in sort of cliches, but you can't see the wood for the trees.
Mm.
And so when somebody's making suggestions, you're still a bit too emotionally wrapped up with it. So once I've started writing a new story, they can do anything to my book. And providing I agree with it, we go ahead. And I rarely disagree because it's expertise and sort of objectivities come into it about what's going to make this really sing, you know, or get these characters to really step off the page.
Yeah.
So.
And then you sort of, you come into the, we're working together to
it's
make this,
a collaboration
this story
then.
Really.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
Something that came out in the paper today, and I've seen it a couple of times this year, is writers who are finding it difficult in the world of Trump to actually find their creative zest or their verve. I mean, I'm sure it's affecting American writers more when it's really on top of them. But there have been a lot of things going on in this last, say, 18 months that seem to have been a bit on the dark side.
Oh, gosh, not just a bit. Mm. I mean, it might explain why we've run away to the country. I mean, I don't live in a city anymore. I've moved to the country. I live on 8 acres. I just want peace. I know that might be cowardly, but... I want to just appreciate a smaller life. I don't need all the bells and whistles. And I agree with you. I think there is a lot of darkness in our world at the moment. And I think maybe books, and that's why books and television are really enjoying a bit of a purple patch at the moment, I think. I mean, the booksellers, even yourselves, are talking about a great Christmas coming up for books because people want some entertainment and escape. And they don't mind if it's darker stories because we're cluey enough to work out what's fiction and what's real, and we don't want what's real. We want the fiction. And I agree with you. It doesn't put me off writing. It makes me just want to write more stories and bigger, better.
And is there any part of your choice about writing about women who are either finding the confines of their age too tight, or is there any sense of that, of reminding readers, especially younger readers, of the struggles to get the freedoms that we have? Because we are in a period where we're watching freedoms actually be taken away from us.
Yes, and we've discussed this quite a few times at festivals and other sort of literary panels where women have come a long way, and we think, yeah, we've got all these freedoms, but you know, actually we're still confined by a desire to have family, and most of us would like to be married when we have those families, and I think that all takes management, because if you're trying to forge a career as well, and trying to have a good and varied and interesting life, and why wouldn't you? You've still got all these constraints that, you know, will pull you back into the household, so to speak. So, and I, you know, it doesn't matter how many decades have passed. You talk to a young woman of today, and the majority of those young women are looking forward to getting married and having a family. So nothing's changed from 1933 when I'm talking.
So in essence, if you're imaginatively going through this as a virtual reality experience, reading the book, and you're seeing the extra stuff that's piled on, and she's making her choices within that extra, it's like carrying extra weight before doing a running race or something, you come back into reality and you haven't got as many of the social confines around you. Maybe people could
Feel better.
Feel
you
better
could,
and
you
do
could
bit,
say... Well, she did under those constraints, so I can.
Yeah, that
with
kind
more
of...
freedoms.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there are lots of parallels, and that's why I try to avoid the really sweet ending all the time. I mean, I think the reader sometimes wants a sweet ending because it makes them feel better after punishing a character all the way through. But I prefer the bittersweet ending because I think it delivers that sense of hope, but it also keeps it a little bit more real, a bit more authentic for
Is there a way of doing that where you have an ending which is a one battle, but the war isn't over? Like, is that kind of...
Yes, yes. I mean, but then I get lots of mail from people saying, so what happened then? And I have to say, and they say, you are going to write another book, aren't you, about this? And I often say no when I'm done. I write them. I definitely try and write them one at a time. You know?
But that must be marvelous, just having someone that involved.
Yes, and that's what you have to remember as well as a writer, that you're... It doesn't... The Tea Gardens is coming out right now. It's not yet out October 30. I'm already nearly finished on the next one, and I am already researching the 2019 book. So my mind is very much with the 2019 book. Story and what I have to research, but I have to remember that there are people sitting there right now who haven't read The Tea Gardens. They're still involved with the chocolate tin, and they want to know what happens to those two characters after we leave them. And I'm thinking, yeah, where do we leave them again? You know, so it's a terrible thing to say, but and then when you get books that people come up that you wrote, I've written 35 books now. If they ask me about book number 3, I have to really pause and think it through, and I think, which Duke was that? You know, in which story?
Well, it's like a book you've read by this stage. Yes. It's like when a book you read a long time ago.
Yes, I can't remember all the detail, but the person that's just read it, it's very real to them, and they're very involved with those characters and that story, and they may be emotionally wrapped up in that story. So I pay an enormous amount of respect to the reader.
I get a much better idea of how you can produce how much you do when you have it so overlapping. It makes so much more sense to me now. I was trying to work it out. I'm trying to go, there's 12 months in a year, and if you do
I just work on 3 books at a time.
Yeah, that's the secret, isn't it?
It is the secret. You're editing one or preparing to go on tour for it. You're certainly at the end stage. You're writing another, and you're researching the third. And if you can hit that lovely rhythm, you're a happy hamster in your wheel, you know?
And then
you go into your den to do your writing, and you come out to do the public stuff.
And it's like a surefire way to avoid all the blues that writers suffer when they're in between things. And you just
I don't have time for what they call writer's block, because I'm always on the next project.
Well, that's we had Aaron Blaby, who's had enormous success with his children's picture books, Pig the Pug, and Bad Guys, and all the things. Great fun. And he started to have success when he started to not do one at a time. So he started to do 3 or 4 different projects at a time. If he got writer's block over there, he just went,
I'll move on to this one.
And he just moved from thing to thing. And his production sped up. And this is your secret.
Yeah, I've never had writer's block. I hope, touch wood, I never do. But I actually don't subscribe to it. I think when people talk about writer's block, what it is some sort of emotional situation that they're facing where they just don't feel like sitting down and writing,
or if they haven't really really faced a problem with the book and they're trying to avoid a problem which means a lot of work,
or some research. They've written themselves into a bit of a corner with the plot and they're not sure how to, I just don't have that. And I write very organically anyway, so I don't subscribe to planning a plot. I just let the plot unfold through the characters. So I'm such a gunslinger, and I annoy a lot of people when I say this, but I just don't even think about it. And I write to a word count as well, which is even worse.
I know, that bit freaked me out last time.
So I just stop in the middle of a sentence.
Yeah, I know,
and just
kills
think,
me.
Don't worry, I hope I remember what I was talking about tomorrow morning. But, you know, it's how I roll. And if it just empowers me, it makes me feel very free. And I get up and think, right, I think I'll bake a cake, or I'll walk the dogs, or it's my time now.
Yeah. So. Fiona, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. I learn so much every time we sit down and have a chat. And this time, the whole 3 book thing, I'm going to take that away.
To see your books next time I come.
Yeah. We'll get there.
I'll read your manuscript.
Yeah. I'll give you 3.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much for coming in.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All of Fiona's books are available at booktopia.com.au right now, and especially The Tea Gardens, which is a perfect Christmas gift, so get a copy. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.